Welcome to Chapter 5. I know we go a little bit out of order in this class. I think that Chapter 5 is a little easier for students to digest than Chapter 4, so I teach it in the order of privacy first and then libel. I don't really want to change the order in the book, though, because I'm probably the only professor who teaches media law who does it this way, but I've had good success, so there it is. A couple things you might not know about privacy. The word privacy doesn't appear in the Constitution. Sometimes students and others make the mistake of thinking it's a constitutional right of privacy. And to some degree, they're right. There have been Supreme Court cases that have recognized rights of privacy in particular areas. We're not going to talk about all those areas. But for example, the Supreme Court has recognized a right to travel. All right, that's sort of a right to privacy, and it's a right that doesn't really appear in the Constitution, but it's derived. All right? A derived right is a right that appears in the Constitution without actually appearing in the Constitution. It might seem a little bit confusing, but the Supreme Court will sometimes say, well, if we look at rights together, we can see that there were other rights sort of contained within the rights that are actually enumerated. All right? So a derived right is a right that was made up, created, and enforced by the Supreme Court. And privacy is one of those rights. We do have a right to privacy, but it isn't directly from the Constitution. Generally speaking, we get it in state statutory laws, so either at the state or local level, or we get it in common law, which is judge-made law. Okay? In media law, the four torts that we're going to talk about, or the four privacy suits we're going to talk about, are torts. We talked about torts in Chapter 1. A tort is a legal wrong that creates the right for one person to sue another. So if I invade your privacy in some way, you need to choose one or more of these torts to sue under if you're a media organization. Okay? And there are four torts that I want to talk about. We'll get to those in a minute. All right. That gentleman there you probably recognize from Chapter 2, Chapter 3. That is Louis Brandeis. Justice Brandeis was around in the 1920s and 30s, up to the 40s. And he was really concerned, even back in the late 1800s, about people intruding on other people's space. All right? So he wrote an article with his law partner, a guy named Samuel Warren, and that was published in an 1890 Harvard Law Review. And in this case, Brandeis was lamenting the fact that the press was starting to intrude on people's solitariness. He writes, "Gossip is no longer the resource of the idle and of the vicious, but has become a trade, pursued with the industry as well as with effrontery." And this was before there were paparazzi. But there were still, you know, yellow journalists who are willing to pry into people's lives for sensationalism, for the ability to sell newspapers. And that was what Brandeis was concerned about. Brandeis argued that we should have a zone of privacy around us. We talked about zones a little bit when we talked about Chapter 3, the idea that we would have some sort of zone around us, perhaps when we moved through an abortion clinic entrance. But in this case, Brandeis was saying, well, there's an area around us that really only the people we want to let in should be able to be let in. And we're going to see a little bit of that in some of the torts we'll talk about. But it wasn't until 1902 when New York passed the first privacy statute. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the chapter. And in 1905, the first common law right of privacy was recognized in Georgia. So it's not a right that's old. It's certainly older than some of our libel rights that we'll talk about next chapter, which really started really in 1964. But we're not talking about ancient rights here. We're talking about rights that actually happened in the 1900s. A couple of important non-First Amendment privacy cases. The two cases on the top are basically cases that have to do with sexuality and pregnancy. Griswold versus Connecticut was the case in which the Supreme Court first recognized the idea of a right to privacy. It's a birth control case. A married couple in Connecticut, the Griswold couple, wanted to use birth control. They're married. Connecticut had a law that said you couldn't use birth control, even if you were married. And the Supreme Court said, wait a minute here. It should be none of our business if a married couple wants to use birth control in the privacy of their own bedroom. And in this case, Justice Douglas essentially took a whole bunch of the rights that are in the First Amendment, the right of association, the right against, you know, search and seizure without permission, the right against cruel and unusual punishment, and said, you know, if we glob all these together, we can see that there might be a right of privacy. So really this case was important because it established for the first time a constitutional right of privacy, even though the word constitution doesn't appear. Roe versus Wade is essentially a privacy case. That's the case in 1973 where the Supreme Court said that the states could not prohibit women in early parts of their pregnancy from having abortions. A very contentious case and still contentious today. Some of the gay rights issues. Now, we're not talking about gay marriage. We talked a little bit about that. Your book talked a little bit about it in Chapter 3. But in these cases, these were gay sex cases. In Bowers against Hardwick, the Supreme Court said that it was okay for Georgia to have a rule that prohibited homosexual sodomy. Case was where two gentlemen were engaged in consensual sex, and there was a knock at the door, and there was the cops there, and they had been turned in, and Georgia had a law that said you couldn't engage in that kind of sex. And the Supreme Court basically said, well, if the state wants to pass that, they can do that. Fast forward to 2003 in the Lawrence versus Texas case, very similar facts, but in this case, the Supreme Court said, look, if there are two consenting adults doing what they do, it should be none of our business what that is, as long as there's consent there and they're both adults. So that's the state of the law in the issue of gay sex. Gay marriage, of course, is a whole separate issue. All right. Let's talk about the four privacy torts. They will be on your exam in several flavors. The first one is intrusion. It's trespass. You guys might have lived next door to somebody who didn't like it when you went on their lawn. We had a neighbor back in Wisconsin who would come out with his BB gun and shake it at us darn kids for getting on his lawn. That's what trespass is. Trespass is the right to keep your property safe. And the intrusion tort derives from that right. Private facts are essentially facts that, if revealed and are private, would be, you know, embarrassing or shocking to someone, particularly if they're true. Truth is not going to be a defense to private facts. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. False light. False light is portraying someone in a false way. Okay? It's similar to libel, as we'll talk about in Chapter 4, but it's a separate privacy tort that some states recognize. And finally, appropriation, misappropriation, and right of publicity. They're all sort of related to each other. Appropriation and misappropriation mean the same thing. But different states use different terms. I try to use the term appropriation. Sometimes I forget. Right of publicity is a little bit different. It's a property right. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But it's basically the right to control the use of your name or likeness for commercial gain. Every state can recognize 1, 2, 3, 4, or none of the privacy torts. My home state of Minnesota recognized none of the privacy torts until the late 1990s. There was a case that happened where a couple of women, friends, had gone to Mexico, and one had taken a picture of another coming out of a nude bathhouse. And somebody at the Walmart where she had the photos developed thought it would be kind of funny to make a lot of different copies of that photo of this nude woman and pass them all over town. The case is called Lake versus Walmart. It's talked about in your book. And she went to recover, and the court said, well, you know, we really don't like the fact that we can't give you any money, but gee, Minnesota doesn't recognize any privacy torts, so you're sort of out of luck. Wouldn't it be nice if we did? And so now, of course, the Supreme Court recognized 3 out of the 4 torts. Here in California, which is really the only place we're worried about, the land of beautiful people, we recognize all 4 torts. Okay, we're going to talk about the first couple in this first section. Let's start with intrusion. It is trespass or unauthorized entry into private spaces. For example, if I'm having dinner with my husband in my kitchen and you barge into my house and take pictures of me and my husband having dinner, you've intruded. You've trespassed. Okay? It does not matter what you do with the pictures you take. Simply the act of trespass or intrusion is enough for me to bring the suit. The actual definition is offensive physical, electronic, or mechanical invasion of another solitude or seclusion. So those big paparazzi lenses, those are intrusive. Those boom mics, all of those can be a form of intrusion because they enhance a person's ability to see into places maybe where they ought not to be seen. And again, if you barge into a private place, it doesn't matter what you do with the product of that intrusion. You can be sued for intrusion and something else. Maybe intrusion and private facts, or intrusion and false light. Or maybe even intrusion and libel, depending on what you publish. Okay? And electronics only make the problem worse. Let's talk about a couple of the cases. I actually found a picture of a quack doctor. This is a quack doctor case. Dr. Dedeman, the Reporters for Life magazine had been tipped off that he was, quote, practicing medicine, unquote, without a license. So they knock on his door. Hey, Dr. Dedeman, we'd like to come in and be your patients. Can we do that? He was practicing out of his home. So Dr. Dedeman invited them into his home and, quote, treated them, unquote, and all the time they were recording him. All right, so he finds out about this when his story shows up in Life magazine, and he sues for invasion of privacy, and he wins $1,000. And Life magazine Time, owns Life magazine, or loaned Life magazine at the time, said, well, wait a minute here. You know, he invited us into his home. How can we be intruding if we've been invited in? And the Ninth Circuit said, well, it's not really a license to intrude, because if he had known that you wanted to report on him instead of being his patients, he might not have let you in. So they said, you know, even though a news gathering is an important part of the First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech and press, the plaintiff's home, or in this case Dr. Dedeman's home, was a sphere from which he could reasonably expect to exclude eavesdropping newsmen. Yes, the language is from the original case. There are newswomen too, of course. But in this case, the court basically said, well, you know, look, if he had known your real intention, you basically lied to him to get entrance into his house, and that's not going to be okay. Let's turn now to a paparazzi case. There are, of course, many of those sorts of cases in the news, but most of them don't get into the courts. They're usually settled out of court. But Ron Galala, what we would call him perhaps the papa of the paparazzi, he would chase Jackie Onassis Kennedy Onassis everywhere to get her picture. Beautiful woman, very photographable, very private. He would do anything to get her picture. He would get in the way of her kids. John Kennedy Jr. was bike riding. He would jump in. He jumped in his way. Carolyn Kennedy was taking tennis lessons. He spied on her. He would date the help. He would find out from the help where she was having dinner and get reservations there and jump out. He would do anything to get the picture. And finally, Jackie said, enough. I can't take this anymore. And she got a restraining order against him. And the court basically said, we recognize that this guy is causing you and your family to have emotional distress. Okay? You've got to stay 25 feet away from Jackie and her family, and you can't block her path. Now, you'll notice there are two dates there, 73 and 82. It's because he kept breaking his restraining orders, basically, her zones of privacy, and so she had to keep going back to court. But it's an important case because it's the highest circuit case that has recognized the idea that we should have a zone of privacy around us when it comes to intrusion. All right. But the Supreme Court has also given us some information on intrusion. In ride-alongs, bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Okay, I won't give up my day job. That's Cops, of course. That's a show about ride-alongs. The media go along with the cops, the men and women of law enforcement in whatever city they're in, and watch what happens. Well, they were able to do that. They still do it. But you guys will notice that sometimes, if you've ever seen the show, sometimes those faces are blocked out. That's because there hasn't been consent. Basically, the Supreme Court has said, the police officers may have a Fourth Amendment right to come into a property, but the media does not. So there has to be separate consent given to the property holders, to the media, to come in. And the case that it was happened is Wilson versus Lane. It's a 1999 case. And Washington Post reporters were with police officers when they went to Charles Wilson's house. Charles Wilson's son had an arrest warrant out for him. And Wilson comes to the door. He's in his underwear. The police serve the warrant, and they come in, and the Washington Post reporters go right on in without anybody's permission. And they write a story about being in Wilson's house. Wilson sees the story the next day, brings suit. The Washington Post basically says, this is part of our news gathering. We should be okay. And the Supreme Court says, no. It is a Fourth Amendment violation for journalists to enter a home without the resident's consent. It's one thing for the police to go in on a warrant, but the media cannot follow without permission. Okay? They wrote, a violation of the Fourth Amendment for police to bring media or other third parties into a home during the execution of a warrant when the presence of the third parties in the home is not an aid of the execution of the warrant. So, in other words, The Fourth Amendment permits the cops to go in. It does not permit the media to go in without permission. And that's still good law today. So if you're going to do police ride-alongs, that's great. Make sure you get permission if you're going to go into someone's house, explicit permission in writing. Or you can film things from the street, of course. We'll talk about defenses in a little bit. A couple other cases. Here's an important California case. It's Schulman versus Group W Productions. Ruth Schulman was driving her minivan on the I-10, and she flipped it over. She was afraid that her son had been killed, and the paramedics who came to rescue her had been mic'd. They were wired. In fact, I went to a conference, and somebody there actually had the video or the audio tape of Ruth Schulman, and it's very gripping. You know, she's moaning. She's saying, I can't feel my legs. Is my son okay? And the paramedics are saying, it's okay. We're going to get you out. So she's lying in a hospital room, and she sees the show come on the air, and she hears her voice and sees her flipped minivan and says, wait a minute, I didn't give any permission for this to happen. So the California Supreme Court gets the case, and they said, yes, Mrs. Schulman, you can sue Group W for damages because they did not obtain your permission. And frankly, there is no reasonable way that the paramedics could have gotten your permission when they're trying to get you out of your flipped minivan. So even though the accident is newsworthy, and frankly, pictures that they took of the flipped minivan from the public are fine, getting in next to her and taping her in this moment of distress without her consent is a no-go. Okay? So, yes, you can get things in a public space, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but again, don't push it too far. All right. Hidden cameras. You guys probably remember the O.J. Simpson case from several years ago. Now, over a decade ago. Beverly Dettoressa had the privilege to serve O.J. Simpson while on his flight from L.A. to Chicago after the slow speed chase and that whole thing. And she served him, and the media found out, ABC happened to find out, that she was O.J.'s flight attendant. So they go to her home, which is in Irvine. They knock on her door, knock, knock, knock. Hey, Ms. Dettoressa, we heard you were serving O.J. Simpson. You were his flight attendant on his flight. Do you care to talk to us? So she's standing on her porch, and she talks to them for a little bit, and then she thinks, wait a minute here. I probably don't want to be talking to these guys. So she says, I'm done talking to you, and I don't want you to use anything we just talked about. Now, she knew that they were reporters. She talked to them knowing they were reporters, and that was key to this case. Because it went to the Ninth Circuit Supreme Court or the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals after they had used that material, and the Ninth Circuit said, "Well, Bev, you talked to these people on your porch in plain view when you knew they were reporters. You never said off the record or no comment or in confidence or anything that would lead them to believe that you didn't want them to use that stuff. And once you've given consent, you can't really pull it back." And there wasn't ever any trespass either, because when you asked them to leave, they did, and they didn't really intrude on any of your space. So she loses. Now, hidden cameras are also a major thing. A lot of news organizations now have been using hidden cameras for many years, and the technology is getting better and better and better. That fuzzy screenshot in the corner, unfortunately, is the only screenshot I've been able to find about this case. Case is Food Lion versus ABC. Two ABC reporters got a tip-off from some disgruntled workers of Food Lion and decided that they were going to investigate some alleged wrongdoing by Food Lion, including some nasty food handling practices. The employees alleged that Food Lion would take the chicken that had expired out of the case, cover it with barbecue sauce, wrap it back up, and sell it again at a higher price as barbecued chicken. Or they would take the dated hamburger and dump it into the grinder with the fresh hamburger, grind it all up together, and sell it again. So they were alleging not only labor practice wrongnesses, but also kind of icky, nasty food handling issues. So two ABC reporters falsified their resumes and got jobs at Food Lion supermarkets. Okay? And they used hidden cameras and tape recorders to tape a lot of stuff. And they used a lot of it out of context. I've seen the whole show. I've seen videotapes of it. They really did not do a very good job of putting things in context. So Food Lion's case was focusing primarily on trespass. They said, look, we never would have given ABC reporters jobs in our deli or jobs in our supermarkets if we had known. So they lied to us to get jobs. And they originally won. Now, the damages were later on reversed. But again, it goes to show you that you can't really lie. Courts get really bent out of shape if you're lying to get the story. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about wiretapping. It's not something that most of you probably do as a matter of course, but the Supreme Court has come down essentially on the side of the media when the media obtains information from a wiretap, as long as they get it lawfully. And you, if you remember, if you're thinking you've heard that before, you have. We'll get back to it in a sec. But in the Bartnicki versus Vopper case, Frederick Vopper was a DJ in a Pennsylvania town. And he obtained from some anonymous source an audio tape that was given to him without a name on it that revealed that Mr. Bartnicki and somebody else were discussing retaliation against some school board members if they didn't agree with them on some school salary. So it was clearly an issue of public importance. The tape was given to Vopper. He listened to it. He thought this is important for the public to know, and he played it. Bartnicki sued for intrusion. And the Supreme Court said, well, Mr. Vopper didn't make the tape himself. He didn't steal it. He got the information lawfully, just like the newspapers did in the Pentagon Papers case from Chapter 3. If the media gets information lawfully, they may use it. Stevens writes, in this case, privacy concerns give way when balanced against the interest of publishing matters of public importance. And again, Pentagon Papers is key. If the media obtains information lawfully, even if it's stolen by someone else, the media can generally use that information. And that has been true in the rape victim name cases that we'll talk about in a little bit again. That's been true in Pentagon Papers, and it gets again true in Bartnicki versus Vopper. Okay. Defenses to intrusion. The best defense for intrusion is plain view. I'll say that again. The best defense for intrusion is plain view from a public place. So, if you are walking on a public sidewalk and you see something happen and you take a picture of it, or you hear people walking in front of you and they're talking and you write that information down, that is all okay because it is in plain view from a public place. Now, if you're using a boom mic to try to pick up, you know, secret information, or you're recording somebody without their knowledge, that isn't necessarily guaranteed protected. But if you are in a public park, on a public sidewalk, even if you're taking pictures from a public sidewalk, that's plain view, and generally speaking, it's okay. Now, if you get consent to come into a place, that's okay. You have to say so truthfully, because you can't, you know, falsify stuff like in Dedeman or in Food Lion, and you can't pry into people's desks or their files if you're there. But if you're invited into someone's home, you can assume that you're not intruding there. And in some cases, newsworthiness can be raised as a defense. If it's really critical that you intrude on some property to get a really hot story that is critical to the to the public to know, all right, some courts have gone with that. But the best defense for intrusion is plain view. All right, let's turn to the second privacy tort of the four, and that is publication of private facts. That gentleman there has no private facts. Private facts is the most commonly sued for form of invasion of privacy. And it is exactly what it seems like. It is publication of facts that you want to be private. And those facts, generally speaking, are more problematic if they're highly offensive to a reasonable person and not of legitimate public concern. Let me give you an example. Let's say that the Daily Titan is doing a profile on me. And they go digging around and they find from some website somewhere, or maybe they know somebody who's worked at a hospital, and they find out that I've had 6 abortions. Now, I haven't. Of course, I've had no abortions. But let's pretend, for purposes of this case, that I have had 6 abortions. And in the story, they say, well, you know, Dr. Belmes has been at Cal State Fullerton since 2004. She's married. She has a cat. She plays World of Warcraft. And, oh, by the way, she had 6 abortions. Now, that's my private fact, right? That is a medical fact about me. It is not of anybody's concern but mine and maybe Doug's, my husband's. And it is certainly something that many people would find to be offensive. That would be a good way for me to litigate. Okay? So that's an example of a private fact. And truth is not a defense, because if it's true, it's even more damaging to me. if the student had reported that I had 6 abortions and it was false, I could just say, well, the student is lying, and I could sue for libel. But in this case, the fact that the information is true is damaging, and I would have to sue for private facts. Okay, let's talk about some of the cases. In last chapter, we already talked about the Supreme Court cases of Cox and Florida Star. Those are the rape victims' names cases. And in that case, the information was gotten from a public record, or it was obtained lawfully from the police, and the court has said, as we talked about in Bartnicki, that if the material is gotten lawfully by the media, they can use it. Again, not to say they should use it, but they can. And that's true even when it comes to juveniles, as the Supreme Court told us in Smith versus Daily Mail. Same kind of situation. The juvenile records were obtained by a news organization. They were published, but they were part of the public record. And the Supreme Court said, well, if you get the information lawfully, it's part of the public record, it's all you. You can go ahead and publish it. 8 states have laws that try to keep names out of the media. And in many cases, the laws have been weakened. The best way that the cops have found to do that is to not reveal the information themselves, to have an internal policy that rape victims' names and juvenile names do not get into the public record. Once they're in the public record, it gets a little bit tougher. Okay, let's talk about some other cases. The first case I'm not going to worry about. I don't have a thing to cross it out. But you do need to worry about the second case, Sittis. Okay? That gentleman there is William Sittis. That is his Harvard graduation picture. He is 16 years old. He's a child prodigy. He was a chess master. He was brilliant. And a news organization decided to do a whatever happened to story. Sometimes they'll do that on the 20th anniversary of something, a whatever happened to story. The reporter finds the guy basically living in a little tiny squalid apartment. He's underemployed. He's doing menial work like a janitor. And he basically squandered all of this brilliant talent. And they didn't write a very nice article about him. They kind of said, well, you know, whatever happened to this guy, so much promise, and it was all wasted. And Sittis said, look, I didn't ask for this publicity. I just want to be left alone. Why can't you just leave me alone? And the Second Circuit said, well, once you're newsworthy, Mr. Sittis, you're always newsworthy. As we're going to find out, newsworthiness is a very powerful defense to private facts. Because once you somehow get in the media, you're somehow newsworthy, you continue to be newsworthy, and a lot of your private facts are no longer really that private. So this is the genesis. The Sittis case is really the genesis of the idea that newsworthiness is a good defense. Let's talk about a couple other cases. The top picture there with the gentleman sort of pushing the elderly lady aside, that gentleman there is Oliver Sipple. He was captured in that photograph at the moment where he is seeing a gun being raised by Lynette Squeaky Fromm, and she's going to shoot President Ford outside the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. He sees the gun come up, he dives for it, he slaps the gun out of Squeaky Fromm's hand, and he saves the President of the United States from being shot. He also happens to be gay, but mom and dad don't know. He's out, however, in the San Francisco gay community. So the newspapers report Oliver Sipple is a gay hero, and his mom and dad disown him. Very sad story. And Oliver Sipple says, but I didn't tell anybody. My parents didn't know. It's a private fact. And the California Appeals Court said, well, you were out in San Francisco. We're sorry that your mom and dad didn't know, but you were out. The fact was not really private. You were active in the San Francisco gay community. You were out to a lot of people there. It's not really a private fact anymore. His parents never spoke to him again. And in fact, there's a bar in San Francisco, I'm told, that if you go in, President Ford and the First Lady wrote Oliver Sipple a letter that said, thank you for saving my life that day. And that's framed and in this bar in San Francisco. And that's really, he died pretty much penniless and lonely. It's a very sad story. Well, slightly less sad of a story is Mike Virgil. That's not Mike Virgil there. But Mike Virgil apparently still hangs around the Huntington Piers. I've had students who have said that they've met him. In 1975, body surfing was a big deal, particularly for those of us in the Midwest who are like, oh, body surfing, how strange is that? Now, of course, many of you probably body surf. But back in the 1970s, it was kind of a big deal. Mike Virgil was a very colorful guy. He boasted of, he liked to eat spiders, and like, I would eat spiders, and then I would tell my boss I was sick, and then I would go surfing. And, you know, sometimes I would, like, pull lumber onto myself and claim that I'd hurt my leg, and then I would go surfing. And some guy once annoyed me, and I bit his cheek off. Kind of not stuff you might want to tell Sports Illustrated, but apparently Mike Virgil told Sports Illustrated all this stuff and more. So there was a consent issue there. And then Mike Virgil went home and thought, wait, my boss reads Sports Illustrated. Maybe it was not such a good thing for me to tell this reporter that I engaged in a lot of lying to my boss. So he calls Sports Illustrated and he says, never mind, don't publish any of that stuff. But Sports Illustrated said, well, you told us on the record, we're going to use it. So they used it, and the Ninth Circuit said, well, it's newsworthy. People want to know about this high-profile, high-risk sport. So Mike Virgil was SOL. Out of luck. Okay. Defenses. The best defense for private facts is newsworthiness. It's not truth. Because, again, if something is true, it's even more damaging. But newsworthiness is the best defense because it wins a lot. Judges say, well, you know, I haven't had training to know what's newsworthy, but reporters have. And if reporters are going to tell me it's newsworthy, it probably is newsworthy. And it's so successful that the defense swallows the tort. In other words, very rarely do private facts cases win in many states because the newsworthiness defense is so strong. So the newsworthiness defense is the best defense for private facts. There's also something called qualified privilege. If a private fact is reported in a public meeting, like a city council meeting or on the floor of Congress, that is also privileged, right? If you report that information truthfully, it is also permitted for you to publish it, even if it's a private fact. Okay, and we'll talk more about that defense when we get to Chapter 4, but still the best defense is newsworthiness. And of course, consent is also a good defense for the publishing of private facts, even if it's revoked, even if you try to take it back. You know, you pretty much put that information out there. If you didn't say it was off the record, it's pretty much going to be fair game for a reporter. But the best defense for private facts is newsworthiness.